Up next on Downtown, a writer for The Ringer and the author of a wonderful new book entitled Answers in the Form of Questions, a definitive history and insider's guide to Jeopardy. We're happy to welcome to the program Claire McNear. Claire, thanks so much for being with us today. I can't tell you how much I loved your book.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Well, you've been writing about Jeopardy for, three or four years now for The Ringer, but what led to the book itself?
Yeah, I mean, I like you said, I'd been writing about it for a few years and had gotten to know more and more people in that community, and there were just so many stories I wanted to tell. Jeopardy is at this moment of change, obviously, in the sense of there will now be a new host, tragically, but also in what contestants are doing. And I wanted to capture that moment of just profound change in Jeopardy, basically every side of it.
Well, and of course, made even more poignant now with the recent passing of Alex Trebek. You talk about it a little bit in the book. What direction do you think they'll go with the show after the end of this year?
Yeah, I mean, it's so tough. It is so hard to imagine Jeopardy with anybody else as the host. And it has been bittersweet for me with my book coming out last week to, have this be happening right now. But I haven't put an excuse to talk about Trebek and talk about Jeopardy. I had the great privilege of getting to know him a little bit while I was reporting, for the book. And he was the first to say that Jeopardy would go on after him, that it was a good enough game, a good enough show, that it would keep going. And I think that the producers, the people at Sony who are making this decision, I think they understand kind of what people want in a Jeopardy host. And I mean, really the best of Trebek was that he kind of was this authoritative scholarly figure, but he was also fun. Like, he was funny. He was good on TV. And I think they know that.
Well, and the behind-the-scenes story, many stories about what Trebek was like when the cameras weren't mm-hmm. rolling, and how he helped to, and you don't think of it as you watch, but how he helped to put people at ease, working the days when he would tape five shows at a time. And he comes across as not a different guy, but a much more well-rounded person than what we see every night.
Yeah, I mean, he was so much looser when the camera stopped rolling. I mean, he was funny. He had this really dark, self-deprecating sense of humor, and you could get a little bit of that on the show, but, you know, he would swear, he would talk about drinking. Like, he was a very fun, you know, kind of like the cool uncle, basically. but when you were actually on the Jeopardy set, and I had the privilege of spending a bit of time there watching him, you could see how much work he was doing on these long tape days. You mentioned that they would film five episodes in a single tape day. He would get there at 6 a.m., sit down with the day's material, crack open a dictionary, mark the whole thing up with diacritical annotations to get the pronunciations just so. When he was actually in the game, so much of what he was doing was kind of like air traffic control and pacing the players and, you know, and just keeping track of the board. Like, it was so much harder than it looked, and that he made it look easy speaks to, like, how good he was and how hard he was working.
Well, the behind-the-scenes people really emerge as a great story and heroes in the book as well. Producer Harry Friedman, who recently retired. But I was fascinated with the story of Maggie Speak. Can you talk about mm-hmm. her role in pulling this all together?
Yeah, so I think people are surprised to learn about Jeopardy is that because of the 1950s quiz show scandals, if you've seen the movie Quiz Show, there's a federal law dictating the sanctity of quiz shows. Basically, it is actually illegal to cheat on a game show like Jeopardy, and so Jeopardy takes it very, 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 very seriously. And one of the results of that is that for contestants, they only interact with the show's contestant department. They, for instance, did not really get to interact with Trebek other than exactly what you can see in an episode where he walks out, he runs the game, he shakes the hand at the end, and that's pretty much it. So the contestant department is this really wonderful group of people, many of whom have been with Jeopardy for decades, and for a long time it was run by Maggie Speak, who just retired. But their job basically is to not only sort of read the contestants in during this very long, stressful day at Jeopardy, but also just, you know, to keep them loose to, when Jeopardy goes to commercial, you can see these people sort of rush up to them and start talking to them. And really what they're doing is, you know, just being like, great job, hon. Like, oh, you're a little slow on the buzzer. I don't know. Like, they're these incredible charismatic people and are really just beloved by the greater contestant community.
We're talking with Claire McNear about her wonderful new book, Answers in the Form of Questions, A Definitive History and Insider's Guide to Jeopardy. I loved reading about the strategy. Let's start with the forest bounce for anybody who doesn't know what that is.
Yeah, so, I mean, as I mentioned at the very beginning, we are at this moment of change for contestants, and what I mean by that is contestants have gotten really serious about how they prepare and the strategies they use when they're playing, and the most famous strategy is the one called the forest bounce, which is named after a contestant named Chuck Forrest, and basically that's where the contestant bounces all over the board. They jump between categories, they jump between dollar values. And when he invented it, and actually it's an old strategy. It dates back to 1985, I believe. It was just the second season of the Trebek version of the show. He really just meant it as a way of confusing his opponents, though of course it also confuses the millions of us watching at home from our couches. But now it's sort of been retooled by people like James Holzhauer, who moved kind of sideways across the bottom of the board, and he was not just trying to confuse his opponents, he was also trying to rack up as much money as he could and also find the daily doubles, which tend to be at the bottom of the board.
I was also fascinated to learn how important utilizing the buzzer properly is, and some of the best, Ken Jennings probably being the biggest one, they're great skill, because everybody, as you point out, everybody knows the answers to the questions. All the contestants are very, very smart people just to get to this stage, but being able to manipulate the buzzer properly is a key part of the success.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a huge part of the game, and it's one you can't really get a sense of when you're watching from home. I mean, obviously there are those moments where you've got the contestant who's just shaking their hand and they can't get in and they're just so upset and your heart goes out to them. But it is this really complex system where I talked to a contestant who compared it to, who said that basically a weird thing about Jeopardy is that we think of it just as a trivia contest, but in fact it's a trivia contest with a like reflex test tacked onto it. So basically, if you can't get the buzzer timing exactly right, you can know the entire board, you can know all 61 clues that are in a game of Jeopardy, but if you can't buzz in before your opponents, you're not going to be able to ring in at all, and you're going to go home. And so it becomes this very precise thing where if you buzz too early, you're locked out of the system for a quarter second, which is usually enough time for one of your opponents to get in. So you have to get in at this precise moment, the moment that Trebek finishes reading a clue. And it's not only really hard and something that contestants really, really prepare for, watching with ballpoint pens for years and years, but, you know, it's this incredible stressful thing as well, that you can't really get a sense of it unless you're on the set.
I don't know if I should thank you for this, but since I read your book, I have gone deep down into the rabbit hole of the J Archive.
Oh yeah. Yeah, the J Archive is this fascinating website, and it is a database created by and maintained by Jeopardy fans. It's not affiliated with the show, and basically what they have done is they manually enter the clues from every single game of Jeopardy. So, if you check it tomorrow, tonight's game will be up on Jeopardy. And they've done this through pretty much all of the Trebek era of the show, so 36 and a half seasons, give or take. And they don't have every single game, but they've got awfully close to that. So it's about, I think, 400,000 clues. So it's become this really vital resource to people who are preparing to go on the show, because it's effectively the entire history of Jeopardy.
Can you explain about the Coriat score and how that works, and how using that, our friend Alan Adams actually won in his appearance?
Yeah, so that is another one of these kind of fundamental tools that contestants have really started to use a lot more now. So that's named after another Jeopardy contestant in Carl Coriat. And what it is sort of a raw number to tell you how a contestant did. So, if the only clues that I buzz in on in a game of Jeopardy are the two $200 clues that, I managed to beat my opponents to, my Coriat score is 400. But if I got one of them wrong, it would be treated as a negative value, so my Coriat is zero. So it really punishes you for the negative answers, but it also takes away the kind of betting elements of the game, so you can get a sense of what you actually know, and that, of course, is really useful for people who are using things like JArchive to prepare for their appearances, because you can basically go through a board all on your own with no opponent fighting you on the buzzer, and get a very good sense of what you know and what you don't know. And I mean, the Jeopardy canon is a fairly static thing. So, you know that you need to know opera, you need to know ballet, you need to know all these other things.
I was also glad to see another friend of ours was one of the many contestants you talked to, Ted Berg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ted is wonderful. Ted told me one of my favorite things I learned about Trebek, which is that Ted played, and you can see in the closing moments of Jeopardy episodes, you can see Trebek walk over to the contestants and shake the hand of the champion, and you can't really hear what anyone's saying. They cut the microphones. And for Ted's game, and what I've since learned is this is pretty common, Trebek just wanted to talk about the final Jeopardy clue. None of them had gotten it. It was at a Hawaiian volcano, and they were looking for Kilauea, the name of the volcano there, and they couldn't quite get to it. But Ted knew it was a Hawaiian volcano. He just couldn't remember the name. But Trebek, so much of the time, if he thought it was a hard clue, he would be saying to the contestants, like, oh, wow, you know, how did you get that? Like, really, did you get this hint in it? Like, he was really impressed by it. Or in the case of poor Ted, who's heartbroken, having just lost on Jeopardy, kind of being like, oh, come on, don't you remember seeing this in the news with the lava pouring down the street? And it was something that Trebek really cared about. He actually cared about the material. He cared about these facts. It was sincerely really important to him.
It was fun, too, to learn even more about, I was going to say the big three of James Holzhauer, Ken Jennings, mm-hmm. Brad Rutter, but so many of the really, really successful champions, Buzzy Cohen, who was a big help to you in the book, Austin Rogers as well, and along with the incredible skill, they also had the component that a lot of people forget about when the folks at Jeopardy are searching for contestants, and that's having that personality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that has become a really significant part of the game in recent years, where, I mean, they want people first and foremost who are very, very bright, who will do well on the show, who know all this stuff. To get to Jeopardy, you have to take this famously difficult 50-question test. If you do well enough, about 100,000 people take it every year. If you do well enough on that, about 2,500 people get invited to take a second version of that test at an audition, usually in person, this year on Zoom. And then the final component of that is basically a television readiness test, because Jeopardy is also a TV show, and the producers want to make good, entertaining TV. And so, you know, obviously, as I said, they are still going for very, very bright people, and people like Buzzy and Austin, of course, are. They won a whole bunch of games, a whole bunch of money. But they also had fun with it. They were fun to watch on the show. You know, you're rooting for them, or maybe you're rooting against them. Like, they're actual characters on the show, and it really has changed the way that you watch Jeopardy.
I just want to be a fly on the wall one night at this weekly gathering at O'Brien's in Santa Monica. But you got to participate in this incredible trivia contest among, the best and brightest of the Jeopardy world. Was that intimidating at all?
Yes, absolutely. I did terribly, but fortunately, some very smart people had invited me onto their team, so they managed to pull out the victory, no thanks to me at all. But this was one of the things I really wanted to capture in the book. There is this amazing Jeopardy alumni community, people who've been on Jeopardy kind of stick together. There is a private Facebook group that you are invited to if you have made it to Jeopardy. This kind of, you know, ceremonial invitation arrives the day that your episode airs. And in Los Angeles, there is this community of Jeopardy fans that meet every week online, of course, right now, at a bar in Santa Monica called O'Brien's. And they have this just famously really tough weekly pub quiz. And it's often written by the actual Jeopardy contestants. And I mean, these are people like Brad Rutter, like Buzzy Cohen, like Pam Mueller, like Alan Lynn. They are very, very accomplished Jeopardy contestants, some of whom have won a whole bunch of money. And they just come out every week to just keep playing trivia. It is such like a calling for a lot of the people who go on the show.
And that tight alumni group isn't limited to the people who've won the Tournament of Champions or have been immensely successful. Even the folks who have gone on once and absolutely flopped in their appearance still take great pride in getting to the show, because just being on is such an accomplishment.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I mentioned the numbers just now of the 2,500 who make it to the audition at all, which itself is an accomplishment. Only about 400 make it to Jeopardy in a given season. Like, there are only about 230 episodes. They have tournaments. It's very selective, and people spend years and years trying to get there. But once they do, unfortunately, they have to play against other Jeopardy contestants, and the numbers are really, really stark. Just about 75% of contestants on Jeopardy lose their very first game. They never win. But having done that, having been on that stage, having gotten to that stage is so hard to do and is such like a weird, fantastic experience for so many of them that I think it rightfully becomes an identity to some degree. I mean, you see on social media, like on Twitter, so many people have like bronze medalists on Jeopardy in their Twitter bio. It really is this lasting part of their identity. And having spent some time in that world, I absolutely understand why.
So after spending all of this time researching and writing this wonderful book, what do you think is the biggest reason why the game still resonates so much through America after nearly four decades?
Yeah, that really was one of the central mysteries to me, because game shows come and go. And why is this, you know, very staid trivia game, this ratings hit? I mean, about 10 million people watch it every night. And I think it is a credit to Alex Trebek, who, of course, spent 36 years and change as the host and was just so good at it. But it's also, I think, a testament to the writers in particular, because they do a really good job with the material. It is hard. Of course, it's hard. But they've found this sweet spot and stayed in this sweet spot for decades of hard, but it's still interesting. You know, if Jeopardy were insanely tough stuff nobody had ever heard of, it wouldn't be fun to play from your couch. You know, it's not fun to watch three people say a bunch of names that you've never heard of. But they have done this really fantastic magic trick, kind of you know, deploying pop culture and deploying clever writing that often has, you know, kind of a hint in it, and just making this really smart game that's also really fun.
Well, it is an immensely entertaining book, Answers in the Form of Questions, A Definitive History and Insider's Guide to Jeopardy! The Forwards by Ken Jennings. Claire McNear has done such a wonderful job on this. I hope you can get your wedding rescheduled here at some point.
Yeah, we're still working on that. We were supposed to get married in March, and, you know, so far just still engaged.
Well, listen, we appreciate you making time for us. I love the book. We wish you continued success. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving as well. And thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Claire McNear, talking Jeopardy with us here on Dantown.